This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Jennifer Lawrence, is starring in two new films, the fourth and final installment of the action series The Hunger Games and the new film Joy. Joy is Lawrence's third film directed by David O. Russell. Lawrence won the Oscar for Best Actress for Silver Linings Playbook and was nominated for Oscars for American Hustle and her breakthrough role in the independent film Winter's Bone. Joy is a comic drama loosely based on the story of Joy Mangano, who invented the Miracle Mop and other household objects and became known not only for her inventions, but for her sales pitches on QVC and the Home Shopping Network. In the film, before Joy is a successful businesswoman, she's lost and having trouble making ends meet. When she invents a self-ringing mop, she can't find anyone to sell it until she goes to QVC and meets with an executive played by Bradley Cooper. Terry spoke with Jennifer Lawrence last Monday and began with a scene from the film. Joy is confronting Cooper's character after a QVC pitchman botched an on-air demonstration of the Miracle Mop.
I'm in a meeting with our lawyers.
What do you think you're doing?
Go home, Joy, and watch the numbers roll in on television. Make 50,000 mops, borrowing and owing every dollar, including your home.
It could have been handled better. I'll let Todd have another shot.
I don't want Todd or anyone else to try it. It should be me.
We don't have regular people. We have celebrities whose spokesmodels do the selling. I told you this.
Who showed you the mop? Who sold it to you? Who taught you how to use it? And who convinced you that it was great after you thought it was worthless?
Excuse me, can you give us a second?
That's a scene from Joy. Jennifer Lawrence, welcome to Fresh Air. As part of your preparation for the film, did you try out the Miracle Mop, the self-ringing Miracle Mop?
I did not. I probably should have.
I can't believe you didn't.
I did mop, but I didn't have a Miracle Mop. I had a sponge mop. They did mop, and then there was a mop in my trailer. And so I would practice it, you know, practice like technique and just kind of getting used to it. And there were so many Miracle Mops on set. I would start working them and like really just trying to study it, because the amazing thing about Joy, a lot of people have inventions or they have ideas, and then they bring it to somebody else and say, I have this idea, I don't know how to make it. But Joy grew up in a metal garage, so she was in complete control of all of her creations, and this is how I want it to be made, which is very different than just having an idea. So I studied the mop more to just try to understand somebody's mind, peeling it back and looking at each, you know, how would you think that this clipping onto this and then a cup holding here, and then all of that fascinated me. So I dealt with the mop, but when I first showed Bradley Cooper in the showroom the mop, he watched me and he was like, no, Jen, that's not how you mop. And he showed me how to properly mop.
I read that Bradley Cooper actually used the Miracle Mop when he was in college.
He did. His mom watched QVC every day. They always had QVC boxes in the house. I mean, he knew all about that world. And I knew nothing. And I had an OCD mom, so she would always give us a bunch of chores and tell us what to do, but she couldn't actually live with it being done the wrong way. So it never actually mattered. She would always end up doing it.
So one of the trademarks of David Russell's movies, particularly the trilogy that you're in, Silver Linings Playbook, American Hustle, and Joy, is that they're very kinetic. There's always movement happening, like characters are walking in and out of the frame, and like scenes just kind of blend into another. And I'm wondering how aware you are of that when you're on camera and the film is being shot. Do you have any sense of what it's going to look like, how it's going to be edited, how kinetic it's going to be?
No, and it's such a great thing, because on set, you know, every time you do a movie, it's scary because you can read a script and say, I love this script. Oh, this is a great co-star. This movie's going to be great. But you don't really have control over it. You know, you can walk onto a set and be like, this set is terrible. This is, you know, you start watching the director and you don't have any control. But with David, I have 1,000% trust. So all I do is focus on my performance. And it's not until seeing the movie that I see an amazing camera move that he did, you know, or notice that Eastern Airlines like zoom in past all of the people or something like that. On the day, I don't pay attention to any of it.
The first movie that you made with David O. Russell was Silver Linings Playbook. You won an Oscar for your role in that. So I want to play a scene from that. Bradley Cooper plays someone who has bipolar disorder. He gets out of a mental health facility at the beginning of the film. He is obsessed with getting back with his wife who has left him. In the meantime, you play his best friend's sister-in-law. You're a young widow who has her own mental health issues, but you get him, you understand him, and you've enlisted him to be your partner in a dance competition. But one day he doesn't show up for rehearsal because his father, played by De Niro, needs him at the Eagles game. The father is a bookmaker, and he's got a lot of money riding on this game. But Cooper gets into a fight at a tailgate party, never makes it into the stadium. And when the Eagles lose, the father blames Bradley Cooper's character for the loss and for bringing bad luck. And he's blaming you, too, for bringing bad luck because he thinks you're taking up too much of Bradley Cooper's time. So this scene takes place at the home of the Bradley Cooper and Robert De Niro characters, their family, after the game, after the Eagles lose. You walk in, and De Niro tells you that the bad luck is basically your fault.
Ever since you think
that I'm why today's happened.
That's right. You are why today's
I'm the reason
happened.
Why today happened.
I think so.
Let's talk about that.
Be my guest.
The first night that Pat and I met at my sister's, the Eagles beat the 49ers handily 40-26. The second time we got together, we went for a run, and the Phillies beat the Dodgers 7-5 in the NLCS.
She's right, Dad.
The next time we went for a run, the Eagles beat the Falcons 27-14.
Wow.
The third time we got together, we had Raisin Bran in the diner, and the Phillies dominated Tampa Bay in the fourth game of the World Series 10-2.
Oh, wow.
Fascinating. Well, let me think about that. Wait a minute.
Well, why don't you think about when the Eagles beat the Seahawks 14-7?
He was with you?
He was with me. We went for a run.
Really?
There have been no games since Pat and I have been rehearsing every day. And if Pat had been with me like he was supposed to, he wouldn't have gotten in a fight. He wouldn't be in trouble. Maybe the Eagles beat the New York Giants.
She's making a lot of sense, Pop. That's all right on all accounts.
That's Jennifer Lawrence in a scene from Silver Linings Playbook. David O. Russell sometimes gives actors music to listen to help set the mood. Has he given you music to listen to for your roles?
A little bit. We normally start arguing about that, though. I always think it's annoying, but it's necessary. But I was asleep one time. We were flying to New York together, and I was fast asleep on a flight, and all of a sudden, there was an earbud shoved in my ear with music from Raging Bull. And I was like, what the fuck? So it's basically everything that David and I argue about on the day that I think is unnecessary. David, I don't want to talk about the scene. I don't want you to go through the whole movie with me. Like, I know what the movie is about. Let's go. I don't want to listen to this song when I see the movie and I see what he's doing and how he's put everything together. I'm always wrong. It will always change something in some way that I didn't know. You know, in Silver Linings, when Bradley and I are at a diner and I'm talking about how I got fired from work by having sex with everybody in the office, I had read the scene one way. Bradley and I had both read it a certain way, and we're doing the scene, and then David told us to do the entire thing in slow motion, which seemed like a crazy note. And we did, and that is the scene that's the take they ended up using, and it looks phenomenal. And it felt so weird, and all, you know, I questioned him. I think on the next one, I'll finally stop questioning him.
So, what was the difference between the way you were doing it and the slow motion in terms of the meaning it gave that scene?
I was just doing it very matter of fact. You know, this is what happened. So I had sex with everybody in the office, and then I got fired, and you know, so then I sued them for sexual harassment, just kind of how somebody would discuss over dinner how you got fired from your job without really any feeling in it. You know, just kind of, yeah, this happened. And when he told me to do it in slow motion, I realized I was seducing Bradley, and that changed the whole meaning of the scene in the moment. Because that made complete sense, because of course she would be, because she probably is doing that. She probably seduces people without even knowing that she's doing it. That's where her comfort lies, is being found sexy by people.
Jennifer Lawrence, how did you get the role of Katniss in The Hunger Games? What did you have to do in the audition? Did you have to show off your use of a bow and arrow?
I did not. That came after the job. I auditioned with the scene after I've been chosen, after I volunteer and I have to say goodbye to my family, and the scene with PETA in the cave when his leg is hurt. Yeah, I auditioned and the director cried, which I took as a good sign. And then I left and they offered it to me. I really wanted it really badly. I loved the books. I loved the idea of it. And then when they offered it to me, I took a few days before saying yes, which an executive told me later he thought was a negotiating move, which it wasn't. It really hit me what a huge decision it was. It was such a, you know, Twilight had come out and we had seen how big those were and how instant that was. And I had really, you know, kind of done indies and I just thought it needed more thought. You know, a yes or no question very rarely changes your entire life. Just saying yes to something. So I just thought it needed some thought. So I thought about it for a few days and I said yes, and I'm very happy I did.
What was the thought process like when you were weighing the pros and cons of saying yes? What were some of the things in each column?
I would go, you know, if I was sitting, I remember sitting with a friend eating and I was just wondering, you know, what is it going to be like a year from now if these movies come out? Am I even going to want to be able to do this? My parents' house, when I go home, like, it's not private. Are our neighbors going to be, you know, and I was right about all of these things. My parents did eventually have to move. I was just thinking about fame, really, and also just kind of my future. I don't know if men do this, but as a woman, I've always imagined being a mother, and I've always loved acting, but I didn't think it would take up a huge part of my life. I thought, you know, I'll act, I'll do some movies because I really love it. And I was happy. I was originally just on a sitcom, and I was happy to just stay on the sitcom forever. And so I was kind of a little bit more casual about acting and was more kind of focused on my future kind of as a human and being a mom. And I don't know, what would that be like, being a super incredibly famous person? How would that affect everything in my future? I just wanted to just think about it.
And so when you decided to say yes, were you... Did you feel resigned to the downside of fame?
A little bit. I mostly just kind of said, you know what, I love this character, I love this movie, I believe in it, and I'm going to say yes for the same reasons that I would say yes to any indie. And then, but I was still afraid of those things. But I remember there was a moment when I was on set of The Hunger Games, and I was like thinking about my life, and I was like, you know what, I don't like going out. I'm a total homebody. I'm always looking for excuses not to go out. I was like, I'm actually probably built for this. I can now use fame as an excuse. I can't go there. I'm too famous. And I do.
I don't think I've ever heard that before, that it's a great excuse to not go out.
If we had each other's numbers, I'd be like, nah, why don't you guys come over here and we'll drink wine? I'm too famous to go to that restaurant.
So I know a little bit about a bow and arrow because when I was in summer camp, we were taught archery. So I feel like I'm qualified to ask you, what was it like to learn how to become a master archer?
It was really cool. I really, really enjoyed archery. I had an amazing instructor, Katuna. She was Georgian. She was an excellent instructor, very strict. You know, if I had bad form, she'd pinch my ear. She didn't really put up with anything. And it totally changed my body. It was so crazy when I went back for the fitting for the second movie for Catching Fire. My shoulders were 2 inches broader. My right arm is 1 inch longer than my left arm, permanently, I guess. But I really enjoy it.
She should actually punch your ear if you did something wrong.
Not punch it, pinch it.
Oh, pinch it.
Sorry, God, I'm happy we straightened that up. Yeah. She'd punch me in the head.
Lawrence says she was discovered in Union Square when she was 14 while vacationing in New York with her mother.
I was watching street dancing and some man said, I am a model scout. Can I take your picture? And I was like, oh, well... Yeah. My brothers always talked about how ugly I was. That was a shock. So I let him take my picture. And, you know, my mom and I didn't know that any of this was creepy. We were just from Kentucky, which it wasn't, and ended up being creepy, but that it could potentially be creepy. And so she gave him her number, and he called the next day and said, oh, you know, all these modeling agencies want to meet with her. And we didn't have anything else to do in New York, so we went to the meetings. And then somewhere in there, I read my first script, and I knew.
So your brother used to tell you were ugly?
Yeah, I, you know, they were brothers. They used to call me Uggs before Uggs were, you know, the boots.
Did you believe them?
And yeah, but it didn't. I didn't care. It didn't matter. I feel like if I have a daughter one day and she asks me if she's pretty, I'm just gonna be like, why does it matter? I never grew up with that ever. It didn't really matter to me.
Yeah, I like your answer. Why does it matter? Think that's good.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I remember one time crying because these girls at school left me out. Everybody was going to the movies and they didn't invite me. And my mom was trying to comfort me. And she goes, they're just jealous of you. My brother walks in and goes, don't tell her that. They probably don't like her because she's an and he goes, don't ever think somebody doesn't like you because they're jealous.
My grandmother used to say,
way too much
it's because they're jealous.
And
I knew that was not it. I know it's really like an annoying.
I don't really
totally
think that's a
answer.
Very good lesson to teach somebody. I think you should look in at yourself. If you feel like somebody doesn't like you, think back. Is there something you could have done? Mm-hmm. Could you have offended them? I don't think I should just go, oh, you're just jealous. Like, why would you put that in your kid's head? Like, my mom, bless her heart, you know, this is what moms are for, and I'm probably going to do the same thing when I'm a mother. You know, when we're watching Joy, and then I forgot that the singing part comes on, and I'm like, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. And I put my hands on my head. I'm like, I can't watch it. And my mom listens. She goes, you are the best singer in the entire world. You are the greatest singer in the whole world. Just very sweet. But I'm like, but that's just not true.
So you said a couple of things, a couple of big public statements that have actually made news. I want to ask you about what you said after the Sony hack. Mm-hmm. And when a lot of Sony emails, people, executives who worked at Sony, a lot of their emails were made public. And through those emails, you learned that men you worked with on movies were getting paid much more for those movies than you were. Mm-hmm. And you attributed it to a gender double standard. And you wrote about it. In Lena Dunham's publication, Lenny, you wrote, I didn't get mad at Sony. I got mad at myself. I failed as a negotiator because I gave up early. I didn't want to keep fighting for millions of dollars that, frankly, due to franchises, I don't need. Parentheses, I told you this wasn't relatable. Don't hate me. And then you wrote, but if I'm honest with myself, I would be lying if I didn't say there was an element of wanting to be liked that influenced my decision to close the deal without a real fight. I didn't want to seem difficult or spoiled. And then you say you realized from the hack that, quote, every man I was working with definitely didn't worry about being difficult or spoiled. So how did you decide to say that in public?
I was aware of gender inequality, of the, you know, 21% general pay gap between men and women. And you know, when that hack happened and I saw those numbers, I really didn't look at that and say something unfair was done to me. I think that it's very possible that when we're talking about this gender bias, that it also exists in us as women. It's very possible as individuals are doing this to ourselves, that we have a historical global reputation that isn't being a baller or badass or being aggressive. You know, that's not attractive to do those things. But more than that, you know, but that wasn't really the pay gap. The pay gap and why I wanted to discuss it was because I was like, if I'm having these feelings, and it's my own kind of mentality that's getting in my own way, and these statistics are inarguable. Maybe I'm not the only woman who feels this way, and I figured if I had a voice, I should use it.
How did you start thinking this way? Did you always think this way? Is this a kind of thinking that came recently to you?
I think I've always been outspoken and opinionated, but I'm growing up and learning more.
But I'm talking specifically about just thinking in terms of gender, about what gender equality
of gender,
means
it was
now.
Recent. It was recent. It was getting into the world of commerce. It was getting into, you know, having a power on mm-hmm. set and not wanting to use it or not wanting to recognize it because, I just want to be likable. I just want to be likable. And then realizing you just get screwed over. So I think it developed over time from working because I was saying yes to these things and doing overtime for free and all this stuff because I wanted to be liked. It just seemed ridiculous. And I didn't meet one actor who would do the same. I didn't meet one male actor who did the same thing.
Something else that you said that you were very outspoken about. After your iCloud account was hacked and naked pictures of you were posted. You called it a sexual violation, and you said anybody who looked at those pictures, you're perpetuating a sexual offense. You should cower with shame. You were quoted as saying that in Vanity Fair. And that's a very strong thing to say. And I thought it was very interesting that instead of being embarrassed or anything that these pictures were shown, you expressed anger not only at whoever hacked and posted these, but at anybody who was just going to look at it thinking, like, well, it's posted. Everybody else is looking, so why can't I? You said they were guilty too. Can you talk about deciding how to frame your feelings about the hack of your photos?
I wasn't the first victim of that. You know, there have been hacks like that going on for years, and I have never once, ever looked at a photo of a naked person's body without their permission. I think that that's a disgusting thing to do. And, you know, when it happened to me, I wasn't embarrassed. I was in a long-distance relationship for 4.5 years. And even if I wasn't in a long-distance relationship, it wouldn't matter. It was my body. It was my private email. And I had the freedom to do what I wanted. And I can't really describe to you the feeling that took a very long time to go away, wondering at any point who's just passing my body around, who's got a picture of my body on their phone and is at a barbecue and looking at them, or who's – it was an unshakable, really, really awful feeling that after it healed a little bit made me incredibly angry.
As a woman who is now an action star, in addition to being an indie movie star, what are some of the things that viewers project onto you in your action star persona?
You mean like project onto me in my personal life?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I feel like if I go to a spinning class, I'm like, God, I can't quit. Everyone's going to be like, Katniss sucked out. I don't know. I think that you're always aware, just as a celebrity in general, that there can be one moment. You know, I always hear my friends and family will tell a story about a celebrity. I don't think they're very nice, because they were offered popcorn and they said, you know, I'm not a big fan of popcorn. It's like, who doesn't like popcorn? I don't think I like them anymore. And I'm like, oh, God. Like, how many things have I said that, like, you can't? It's amazing how you celebrities, there's this some bizarre thing where, like, you say one thing, you do one thing, you know, and if you don't know a person, how you can judge your entire being based on, you know, one thing that you've said. It's a huge amount of pressure.
Jennifer Lawrence, thank you so much for talking with us. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Jennifer Lawrence spoke with Terry last Monday. Lawrence is currently starring in the new film Joy, which has just opened in theaters. Another film out this Christmas weekend is Quentin Tarantino's new Western, The Hateful Eight, starring Samuel L. Jackson, Kurt Russell, and Jennifer Jason Leigh. Justin Chang has this review.
When the script for his post-Civil War Western, The Hateful Eight, was leaked on Gawker last year, Quentin Tarantino almost decided not to make the movie at all. I'm glad he changed his mind, though others will surely wish he hadn't. This being Tarantino, it will surprise no one to hear that the movie is a slow-burning talkfest that escalates in its third hour into a hideous bloodbath. But there's no cathartic kick to the violence this time. Unlike the director's previous historical fantasies, Inglourious Basterds and Django Unchained, or his martial arts extravaganza, Kill Bill, The Hateful Eight is not a movie driven by revenge. It's a nihilistic and unapologetically nasty piece of work, with a chill that seeps into your marrow. Not unlike the blizzard that rages outside a remote Wyoming outpost, where 7 mysterious men and 1 very mean woman have taken shelter. One of the men is a bounty hunter named John Ruth, played by Kurt Russell, and his mission is to deliver the woman, Daisy Domergue, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, to the town of Red Rock, where she will be hanged for murder. They're joined by another bounty hunter, Major Marquis Warren, played by Samuel L. Jackson as the movie's most florid and intimidating personality, and the closest thing it has to a protagonist or a conscience. As a black man who once fought in the Union Army, Warren immediately antagonizes the Southerners in the room, who include a small-town sheriff, played by Walton Goggins, and an ex-Confederate general, played by Bruce Dern. But the lingering seeds of Civil War resentment are not the chief source of tension here. As Ruth explains to Warren not long after they arrive, one of the other men in the room is secretly plotting against them.
One of them fellas is not what he says he is.
What is he?
In cahoots with this one, that's what he is. One of them, maybe even two of them, is here to see Domergue goes free.
Are you sure you ain't just being paranoid?
Our best bet is this duplicitous fella ain't as cool a customer as Daisy here. He won't have the leather patience it takes to just sit here. He can't handle it. He'll stop waiting. Try and create his opportunity, and that's when Mr. Jumpy reveals himself.
And what you got to say about all this?
What I got to say? About John Reese Ravens?
He's absolutely right.
Me and one of them fellows is in cahoots. We're just waiting for everybody to go to sleep.
That's what we're gonna kill you.
In some ways, The Hateful Eight is Tarantino's subtlest, most pared-down genre experiment yet. It's Elmore Leonard crossed with Harold Pinter, or perhaps Agatha Christie by way of Sergio Leone, a connection driven home by a darkly brooding score by the great Ennio Morricone. As is often the case with the director, the suspense comes not from the carnage so much as its anticipation. The characters talk and talk, revealing or not revealing much about themselves, and demonstrating once again that no one can write dialogue with quite the same profane brilliance as Tarantino. The camera prowls the room like an invisible ninth guest, and ever so slowly, a sense of dread begins to coil itself like a noose around the characters and the audience alike. When the tension finally snaps, it's safe to assume no one will emerge unstained. Yet The Hateful Eight never loses its grim humor, even as it becomes an all-out horror show, and the performances retain an astonishing sense of control. Jackson, in his sixth collaboration with Tarantino, makes a brilliant detective and master of ceremonies. Goggins, known for his work on The Shield and Justified, is a hoot as a racist hick who becomes an increasingly endearing and complicated figure as the movie's moral compass begins to spin wildly out of whack. But the revelation here is Lee, who plays Daisy Domergue like a cross between Linda Blair and Carrie. She's easily the most hateful character on screen, and her cackling demonic energy is terrifying to behold. This is Tarantino's most claustrophobic movie since his 1992 debut, Reservoir Dogs, which makes it somewhat odd that it was shot on 70mm film, specifically in the old Ultra Panavision 70 format, once reserved for epics like The Fall of the Roman Empire. But Tarantino, high priest of old-school cinema that he is, would have it no other way. The story may unfold in a confined space, but what the director does with it is extraordinary. The tense undercurrents and the ever-present threat of violence add up to a remarkably expansive vision. Many will be displeased to learn that Tarantino retains his fondness for the racial epithet he deployed so frequently in Django Unchained. And yet there's no denying that this movie, in placing our sympathies with the lone black man in the room, is making a statement about the plight of African Americans in this country, then and now. In the guise of a sly genre mashup, The Hateful Eight is genuinely political filmmaking. At the last minute, this fatalistic thriller becomes an elegy for a nation that has long since lost sight of its most cherished ideals. The war may be over, but the storm still rages.
Justin Chang is chief film critic for Variety. He reviewed Quentin Tarantino's new film, The Hateful Eight. The new movie, Anomalisa, is an existential love story about loneliness and disconnection. This very human story is portrayed by doll-sized, realistic-looking puppets. The movie's made with stop-motion animation, and all the sets are handmade miniature versions of the world around us. Everything from planes and taxis to a hotel room and city streets. The film was co-directed by our guests, Charlie Kaufman and Duke Johnson. Kaufman also wrote the film, as well as the films Being John Malkovich, Adaptation, and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and wrote and directed Synecdoche, New York. Johnson directed the Emmy-winning animated episode of the TV series Community. Terry spoke with Kaufman and Johnson last Tuesday. Anomalisa is about a middle-aged man, Michael Stone, who flies to Cincinnati, where he's scheduled to speak at a conference of customer service representatives. Although he's an expert in customer service, he finds it emotionally impossible to connect with anyone, even his wife and child. Everyone looks and sounds the same to him, literally, until he meets Lisa, a woman with a unique face and voice. But it's hard for her to connect because a facial scar has left her feeling disfigured and ugly. So she's astonished when Michael invites her to his hotel room for a nightcap instead of choosing her more attractive friend Emily. Michael is voiced by David Thewlis, Lisa by Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Most people don't really like to look at me too much because, you know.
I think you're lovely.
No, you don't. I've always done phone work because I'd never get hired to work in a store or a restaurant or...
How did it happen? If it's okay for me to ask.
I don't like to talk about it.
May I kiss you there?
Oh my God. Oh my God, no. Oh, God.
Sorry.
You're not like a pervert or something. Like some weird version of a chubby chaser.
No.
I just don't understand why you would want to kiss me there.
Because I like you.
Why? I mean, I'm not smart like Emily, and I'm ugly. You're a really smart guy. You should like Emily. I don't even understand a lot of the words in your book. I sat there with a dictionary. I try to learn, but I'm never going to be smart. And I'm ugly.
I find it enormously charming that you read any book with a dictionary next to you.
And that's a scene from Anomalisa. Charlie Kaufman, Duke Johnson, welcome to Fresh Air. Charlie Kaufman, let me start with you. How would you describe Michael Stone's state of mind? He wants to connect, but everyone looks and sounds the same to him, with the exception of Lisa.
Yeah. His state of mind, I guess, is an inability to connect with people. I don't know other than that what to say. I mean, he's a depressed person, and he's obviously very lonely because of this, and very frustrated, and I think angry.
He stays at the Fregoli Hotel. So, of course, I Googled Fregoli, and there's actually something called the Fregoli delusion, which is, Charlie, you want to describe the delusional belief that's given the name Fregoli?
Yeah, it's a belief that everyone else in the world is the same person in disguise.
It's one person disguising themselves as all these other people?
Yes. It's usually a result of some sort of organic or traumatic brain problem. And in this movie, I used it kind of metaphorically. I wasn't intending for Michael to actually have this condition, but it interested me. The name comes from an Italian quick change artist who apparently, because he's very, I think it was from maybe the late 19th century, early 20th century, so I don't think there's any record of it, but apparently he was amazing at changing his costumes on stage immediately in front of people without them understanding how he did it.
And how did you find out about this?
I have a tendency to read about syndromes. And so, you know, I mean, I look up things like that, and I'm fascinated by them, you know, as actual things in the world, but they also seem psychologically interesting to me to utilize.
Duke, can you explain the kind of stop-motion animation that you use in this movie and how everything in the movie is handmade? From the airplane and the taxi cab to the people to the hotel room, the cityscape, everything is just miniatures that have been made by artists and animators.
That's correct. We fabricate everything. Everything that you see on the screen is made by hand. It's all in 1/6 scale, which is a Barbie's scale. For a frame of reference. So all the locations and sets and cars, and it all exists in real three-dimensional space. None of it actually physically moves in real time. Everything is static, and the puppets are posed in various static positions in a sequence over the course of a series of frames. And when the frames are played back in real time, it creates the illusion of movement.
Kind of like, what are they called? The flip things.
Flip books,
like a flip
or a zoetrope.
Yeah. I think this form of animation where everything is handmade in three dimensions and then shot frame by frame is perfect for the story of this film, because for the main character, everything and everybody looks the same to him. So he's living in this like humdrum, drab world that he can't seem to escape from. He's in a generic plane, in a generic taxi, a generic hotel room. But because of how it's all handmade in the movie, everything looks kind of miraculous to you as a viewer of the film. So you have this kind of tension of the humdrum mundane and the miraculousness of everything being handmade. And it's just a really interesting constant tension between the two. It reminds me, excuse me for being corny, it reminds me of life itself, where sometimes like just walking outside seems like, ugh, another gray day, you know, things are so boring. And other times you walk outside and just like everything seems like a miracle.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And we think that it allows people to focus and pay attention to things that are mundane in a way that they might not be able to in live action. I mean, somewhere in your mind as an audience member, you know that everything that you see has been calculated and choreographed, that there's no accident, that if he drums his fingers against his thigh, that was a choice that we made as filmmakers. And it becomes kind of fascinating because of that.
Duke, when you're shooting these, was it one-sixth size?
That's
one-sixth
correct,
ratio?
Yeah.
So everything is like a sixth of the size it would be in reality.
I was just going to say Michael is our tallest character. He's 12 inches, and that's the equivalent of being 6 feet tall.
So what kind of camera do you use when you're shooting everything in miniature like that?
It's just a still camera, you know, a camera that's typically used for taking photography, you know, mm-hmm. still images, because that's what it is. That's what we work in is static images.
So just so we can visualize how this is done, are all the sets like on a table or are they on the floor? What kind of angle does the photographer have to get to be able to realistically shoot these miniature sets?
Yeah, so basically we have a big empty warehouse where stages are created, different stages. In our case, we had 18 that are separated by sheets of duvetyne that are hung from the ceiling. So you have these sort of black rooms created out of this duvetyne fabric that's used in filmmaking because it has no bounce quality for light. Like if you create a room out of duvetyne, there's total blackness and you have a blank slate to introduce light and create the atmosphere of your choosing. So you have separate rooms divided by this black fabric, and they're anywhere from 15 feet by 15 feet to 40 feet by 20 feet or something. And there's a set in each one of these stages and there's an animator. And, you know, for something like the hotel room, in our case, the hotel room is a large part of the film. So we had to build several hotel rooms. We had 8, and they would be on various stages. And sometimes different parts of the same scene would be animated simultaneously by different animators on multiple stages because the process moves so slowly. It can often take weeks or months to animate a single shot. What happens is we go in and you pose the puppets, you sort of stage it as you would with live action, and then you set the camera angle and you secure it into place, typically with glue. Actually, you actually glue the camera into place so that it doesn't move and you can't bump it over time, and then the cinematographer lights it, you know, just like you would a live action set, but it's just on a miniature scale. It almost looks like a blueprint or a diagram of a live action set.
So you actually glue the camera in place so you have the exact same setup for shot after shot after shot, so it looks like live action, even though it's a series of still photographs.
Yeah, that's exactly right, because, you know, the shots take a long period of time. So if you're just going to do like a like an over-the-shoulder close-up of a character, you know, you could just set that up on a tripod and shoot it if it was live action. But this camera is going to have to sit here for days and days and days, and anything could happen. You know, an animator's animating a shot, and then they could bump it with their elbow, which often happens, actually, and you have to sort of animate the camera back into place. Everything is glued down, actually, in stop motion. All the furniture in the set, they're actually glued into place, and then they have to be freed up from the glue if a character were to interact with it.
The models for the main characters are not the actors who voice those characters. So how did you decide who the models would be? Because you needed models so that you could see how that face looks when it moves. How does that face look when it's sad or when it's happy or when it's sleeping? Charlie, how did you decide who to cast as the models for the puppets?
Originally, we went to stop-motion character designers and were looking for drawings. We wanted these to be naturalistic and seemed to be very difficult for the people that we went to kind of come back with drawings that reflected that. They always had a kind of a caricature-ish, you know, most stop-motion animation, the puppets have very large eyes and, you know, very big hands, and they kind of gesture in very broad ways, and there's practical reasons for that. But, you know, we say we want this to look not like that. We didn't want it to be a kid's movie. We didn't want it to have that kind of cartoonish quality to it, and we weren't really getting the drawings that we wanted. So we started to look for real people that could represent the characters, and we looked online, you know, at middle-aged men and 30-some-odd-year-old women, and we weren't really finding anything that jumped out at us. What happened is that Duke thought of his ex-brother-in-law and showed us a picture, and he was perfect for Michael. So he was brought in, and he became the model for Michael. And then Lisa was somebody that our producer, Rosa Tran, spotted in a restaurant in Los Angeles, and you know, she was approached and asked if she would be a model for this character, and she agreed. So they were photographed making different facial expressions and different mouth movements, and their bodies were changed a bit. Lisa is heavier than this woman. Then once we had these photographs, we had a sculptor named Carol Koch come in and interpret them out of clay, and that's how it happened.
As anatomically correct as your puppets are, when they walk, they have a slouch and a shuffle that looks not quite as realistic as their other aspects, like their facial expressions and other movements. Was that intentional?
Well, we discussed Michael's character early on as you know, he's typically, when puppets are made, they'll be sculpted in sort of a neutral position with their arms splayed out and their shoulders back and, you know, everything kind of in a straight line. But we built Michael's character into his neutral sculpt. He's middle-aged, he's a little overweight, he's got rounded shoulders, his head hangs low. He has a naturally furrowed brow, and he walks with a certain weight. He's throughout the film, actually, he's always a little drunk. He's drinking from the moment he's introduced in the film, you know, pretty much all the way through. So there's that element as well. I'll just add that walking in stop motion animation is probably the most difficult thing you can do, because a lot of times when a character is sitting or they're just standing still and you're moving their upper body and their face and their head, they're grounded to a source, but when they're moving, their whole body moving through space, there's so many elements to consider. There's the arcs of the movement and the weight and the compression of their feet against the ground. And the way that they have these puppets connect to the set is they actually drill a hole in the set, and they put a threaded rod up through that hole and screw it into the bottom of their foot. and that keeps them in place. And then with every step they take, they have to lift that foot up and patch that hole and drill another hole. And actually, for every step, there's two holes that are drilled, because they have a hole in their heel and a hole in their in the ball of their foot, so that they can have the heel to toe movement of an actual footstep. So it's extremely complicated, and only a few animators can actually do it really well.
There's a scene in the hotel where Michael puts on the TV, and the TV is showing an old movie, like from the 1930s. Instead of him watching real actors in this movie, the actors in the movie are puppets too, just like all the other characters in the film. So, like, you're filming a 1930s. Is it a real movie that we're seeing? Is it like a puppet version of a real movie?
Yeah, it's My Man Godfrey. It's an exact replica of that scene.
So we're watching puppet versions of Carol Lombard and William Powell in this 1930s film. That's something really hilarious about that, that you're taking these puppets based on those actors, having them do things that they do in a classic film, shooting it on film, then putting that film on TV and having a puppet watch it.
Yes, it is all of that.
I just love the obsessive nature of that. Charlie, how did you decide that there needs to be a movie that he's watching so that you could do like a puppet movie within the puppet movie?
Well, you know, I'm trying to recreate what it's like to be alone in a hotel room, which I have a lot of experience with. And so I'm thinking of things that happen in a hotel room, and I thought of that. And it was originally Casablanca. In the stage version, but we couldn't afford the rights to that, so we chose this because we were looking for something iconic, but that wasn't expensive, and this happened to be in the public domain.
Well, I want to thank you both so much and congratulate you on the film. Duke Johnson, Charlie Kaufman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Charlie Kaufman and Duke Johnson spoke with Terry last Tuesday. They directed the new stop-motion animation film Anomalisa. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Challoner. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.